one of a handful of players who played in the major leagues for parts of four decades is a feat of tremendous longevity and durability. But Rick Dempsey is one of a very few to have performed this feat as a catcher, the most physically demanding position in the game. So to what does this veteran of 24 seasons and 6 teams attribute most for having such exceptional endurance?
I really attribute it to the fact that I ran track in high school my freshman and sophomore year. I was a miler. And it started in grammar school where I started running long distances to school every day, 6.5 miles, and then back home 6.5 miles. But then when I went to high school, the track coach wanted to see me run the mile. So my sophomore year, I ran a 4:26 mile, so I was pretty good at long distance. And it just kind of carried over. My junior year, I started to play baseball because I liked that a lot more than running track. So I was always a long-distance runner, and I think that's what really prepared me to, you know, with that kind of durability. So you couldn't wear me out. I wasn't a very big catcher because I was always running. Even when I went home from the baseball season, I continued a running program day one that I was home until from the start to the finish of my career.
They send Morgan. It's swung on and missed, and the throw down to second. They nail him.
And we just saw one of the strongest arms in baseball behind the plate in Rick Dempsey's throw. A good jump by Joe Morgan. Took a look at Pete. Pete was taken all the way. You'll see the throw arrive right on the money long before Joe Morgan got there.
Some might question whether or not Rick has the best arm of any catcher in baseball. But if he doesn't, he is very close to it. He is a truly great defensive catcher.
Can you pinpoint a time when you knew not just playing in the big leagues, but catching could be a long-term plan for you?
Well, I liked it. You know, when I started to catch my senior year in high school, I liked it because you were more involved in every single pitch of the ball game. From that point on, I knew I wanted to be a catcher. When I signed professionally, it was just the best position on the field for me. So many guys were so much bigger. I was just kind of I signed originally at 145 pounds, played my first major league game 2 years later at 162, so you could tell I really wasn't very big, but there was a lot of things I could do. I had a good arm, I could hit real well, and, you know, I just, it was just one of those positions where I really enjoyed everything about it, setting up the whole game, calling pitches. You know, you were involved in every single thing in the game.
Starting your big league career in 1969 with the Minnesota Twins, you then went to the Yankees in 1973, and then to the Baltimore Orioles in the middle of the 1976 season, getting a chance to play for Earl Weaver, who would be your manager for the next 6.5 seasons. What was your relationship like with Earl, and how did it evolve over the years?
Well, it wasn't a great one. He was a very, very tough person to get along with. He was a smart... He was probably the smartest manager in the game at that time, and we did realize that he knew what he was doing when he was managing the baseball game. But, you know, it just one of those situations where you didn't like interacting with him because he was always yelling, always screaming about something during the course of the game. But you didn't want to play for anybody else because you knew that if you did play for him, you had to be a pretty good player. Otherwise, he would have never kept you on the ball club. So it had its good side and it had its bad side. But the overall was that he was the best manager. I don't think I ever wanted to play for anybody else because he knew what he was doing. And we learned the game from him.
Upon joining the Orioles in 76, there were a lot of veterans on that club who were part of the championships won in 66 and 1970. Jim Palmer, Brooks Robinson, Mark Belanger, Mike Cuellar, and fellow catcher Elrod Hendricks. What did you learn from them that helped you in your later years as a major leaguer?
Well, there was a lot of things. You know, you got an opportunity to be around veteran guys like that. You pick up a lot, you know, how to call ball games. Jim Palmer was probably the most impressive person that I ever met when it came to learning hitters and how to pitch certain hitters. He had an insight on every kind of pitcher there was. You know, Jim was a power pitcher at that time. He pitched a lot up in the strike zone and got guys to hit a lot of fly balls and let the defense do the work. But with other pitchers like Scott McGregor, Mike Flanagan, having a nice conversation with a Jim Palmer about how I should set up their games was something that really stuck with me my entire career, pitching certain hitters and how to think down and away with the fastball most of the time. Mark Belanger was just a true professional. You know, when it came to running the infield, you would always talk to Mark. He just knew how to do a lot of things. His attitude, his knowledge of the game, and, you know, when to do pickoff plays and bunt plays and things like that. He was just a guy that he really looked to because he knew what he was doing also. That whole team, Brooks Robinson, all of them just had a way about playing a baseball game where you learn to play the game from those guys.
So 3 years after you get there, the Orioles return to the World Series after winning 102 games and then beating the Angels in the American League Championship Series. You guys had Eddie Murray and Ken Singleton in the middle of that lineup, and of course great pitching led by Mike Flanagan. Your opponent in the series was the Pittsburgh Pirates, led by Willie Stargell. Going in, how well did you feel you matched up against the Pirates?
Well, I don't think at that time that we really matched up. We didn't even know. They were a great hitting ball club. Their pitching was okay. It wasn't great. But I think you got up against guys like Willie Stargell that you really knew. He was a great hitter. And, you know, he was always coming up with big hits. So we jumped out to a 3-1 lead really quickly. You know, I just don't think we really realized how good we were at that time. On paper, it didn't look like it was an even matchup, but at the end of it all, Willie Stargell stepped up, got the big hit for them in that last game that ended up winning the World Series for them, and they kind of pieced together their pitching staff. And, those last couple of games, they just got some momentum, and they got a couple of breaks at the right time, and it worked out for them.
Yeah, the Pirates would come back from 3-1 down, winning the last two at Memorial Stadium, culminating in the 7th game with the Willie Stargell home run in the 6th inning. Obviously, an incredible disappointment for you and the team, but when did that disappointment turn into motivation to get back?
Well, probably immediately. We were so disappointed at the end after we basically blew the World Series right there. We gave them the last 3 games. We went home and nobody was in a good mood. I think when we came back again the following year, we had to start to piece it together again. And so we were lucky to get that second shot at it in 1983. And I think we jumped out to a 3-1 lead in that game, in that series also, and there wasn't a sound in the clubhouse on that last day because all of us who were pretty much the same team that we were in 1979, we just realized that we really needed to bear down and get this World Series over with. And so nobody said a word. It was so quiet in that clubhouse for Game 5. And we ended up winning Game 5 and beat Philly 4-1 in the series. So, it had quite an effect on us for a couple of years. I think everybody was very disappointed after 1979.
So going up against the Phillies in 83, a veteran-rich team with Mike Schmidt, Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, and Tony Perez, was there any apprehension on your part knowing you were up against a club with players that not only had World Series experience, but had won before?
Well, they were certainly Hall of Fame guys and really commanded a lot of respect. When you're playing against those sort of guys, you know, you have to bear down. And I think we were all experienced enough to know how to do that. The series started off, we actually lost the first game of that series, but I don't think we lost confidence in ourselves that we could beat that ball club. You know, maybe it would have been a lot tougher if all of them were in their heyday, but you know, I think we really focused fairly well. It was a series where, you know, I got lucky and got the MVP. There was a lot of factors that really went in. It wasn't a big offensive series. It was more of a pitching-rich series for the Orioles, but we had some guys that were going pretty good at that time, and so we were the ones that won the last four games.
Hit to deep left field. Matthews going all the way back, and Dempsey has hit it out.
I wonder how many people were expecting that.
That is some stooge, that Dempsey.
They call the bottom of that order Dower, Cruz, and Dempsey, the three stooges, but they have done the job the entire series.
Got a little lax and threw a fastball right down the center of the plate.
Certainly a leading candidate if the Birds clinch today for MVP.
Well, you certainly didn't allow the Phillies any opportunity to get back in the series, winning Game 5 at Veterans Stadium, as you mentioned, and taking the series 4-1. In Game 5, you hit a home run in the top of the third and was named series MVP with a .385 batting average. The Phillies, conversely, were held to just a .195 batting average. The players that win the All-Star and World Series MVP nowadays get their choice of a car and whatever monetary bonuses come their way. Well, what did you receive upon winning the award?
I won a Trans Am, a car. I took the car. I gave it to my son for his 16th birthday that year. It was quite a gift for a 16-year-old kid. That car was so fast, it scared me to death.
0-2 the count on Maddox. A liner, and the Orioles are the world champions.
Rick Dempsey has just been named the unanimous most valuable player in this, the 1983 World Series.
Well, the most valuable player of the American League in that 1983 season was Cal Ripken Jr. You played with him during his early years when he not only started his amazing consecutive game streak, but when he would play every inning of every game, which lasted into 1987. Was his attitude, work ethic, and stubbornness, if you will, different than any other player you had ever seen?
Well, yeah. You know, he and I were roommates his first 3 years in the big leagues, and the guy had a tremendous amount of energy. He reminded me a lot of myself in that respect because I never stopped working from, you know, 365 days out of the year, and I think Cal was the same way. Cal was a lot bigger and a lot stronger than I was, and he was tremendous. You know, there was no player in the game that worked any harder than Cal Ripken. He just did everything, and he was quite an athlete. You know, he could do anything. He's just one of those kind of people. If you played him in tiddlywinks, basketball, anything, he would find a way to beat you. And that's the way his approach. Every single day he came to the ballpark, he was there to play 9 innings. There was no cutting anything short or taking days off or anything. He is just a tremendous athlete.
Another remarkable streak that you were a part of was Oral Hershiser's 59 consecutive inning scoreless streak at the conclusion of the 1988 season when you were a member of the Los Angeles Dodgers. In the times you caught Oral during that stretch, would you call a game any differently in terms of pitch selection? Were you more conservative, less aggressive with pitch calls than you normally would be?
No, I mean, I would have to say Oral Hershiser, you know, before the game started, you know, you had a pretty good game plan at how he wanted to set it up. The guy had incredible stuff that year, the best sinker I've ever seen in my life, and certainly the biggest, and he had tremendous control. So, I mean, it was just a matter of just getting on board with him, you know, saying, hey, Oral, how do you want to throw this game? How do you want to approach all these hitters? And he would let you know exactly what he wanted to do, so it really wasn't hard to stay on track with him. He got on a roll that was the most incredible role I have ever been on in my life for one season. I've caught, at one time or another, 16 Cy Young Award winners, and that year was the best of the best I've ever seen.
And behind Hershiser and the Kirk Gibson home run in Game 1 of the 88 World Series, you guys won the World Series in five games over the powerful Oakland Athletics. Just describe how amazing that run was, that kind of a magic carpet ride, because you know the Dodgers were given no chance to beat the Mets in the LCS and then were given no chance to beat the A's in the World Series.
I know, you know, it really was kind of magical. We were, Fred Clair, the general manager, put together a team, a lot of platoon players. We only had like three or four guys that played every day. Kirk Gibson was one of those, Steve Sachs, guys like that, Mike Marshall. You know, Bob Costas called us the worst World Series team on paper he had ever seen. And it was kind of inspirational to us at the time because we knew we could win. Every team looked better than we did, but we always seemed to be able to find a way. Reading the Oakland A's at that time, even as strong and as powerful as they were an easy team to read because they made adjustments in the batter's box that were, you know, for example, McGuire and Canseco both, when they wanted to hit the pitch, they wanted to get a pitch on the outside corner, they would come up and they would pigeon toe their stance. And it was easy to see. You kind of funny that both guys would do that. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they did that, we'd pitch them inside. And then when they would open up, they'd come up another at bat and look for the ball middle in. They would open up that left foot and point it towards the shortstop and open their stance up, then we would pitch them away. And it was very, very easy to read them at that point because I think only both of them only got one hit the entire series. So you take those two guys out of the lineup, and it wasn't a tough lineup to beat at that point.
You were one of the best defensive catchers during your time, so you're a good person, I think, to ask about the rule changes recently made with regards to blocking home plate. What are your thoughts on these rules? And based on the reactions we've seen, mostly negative, do you think we'll see any changes in the immediate future?
Well, there's always going to be changes. I was a little disappointed that they made that kind of a change where a catcher couldn't block home plate without the ball, at least stand in the way. You know, because it was a big part of the game back in my days. I got hit so many times at home plate, and I was not a big catcher. One of them one guy that I stood in front of that I probably shouldn't have was Bo Jackson. But you know, it was an opportunity that I saw really to get the team fired up whenever you made a good block at home plate, a tag out and everything. Everybody got pretty excited about that. And sometimes you'd take a beat and some guys would have the advantage because you couldn't watch them all the way and you're waiting for the ball and you're trying to watch the ball at the same time. Well, you know, it's hard to see them make those kind of changes, but when Buster Posey got hurt with the San Francisco Giants, everybody got all upset about that. But you know, Buster didn't do it right that day. It was totally his fault, you know, for breaking his ankle the way that he did. He turned his leg, you know, sideways to the runner coming in, and it was just a freak thing that happened, but it was more his fault than anybody else's, and then all of a sudden they just changed the rule. But, you know, not a bad rule change because, you know, you take that kind of trauma out of the ballgame, you're probably going to have more catchers last longer.
As far as Bo Jackson is concerned, I think only linebackers and defensive linemen should be getting in front of him back in that day.
Hey, I was very proud of it. I got out of that collision with just a broken thumb, but the one good thing was I held him to less yards than Bosworth did.
That's right, you did in the kingdom. Was that the hardest collision you can recall that you ever had?
Absolutely, by far. The guy was 245-pound, world-class speed, and you couldn't put three of the best base runners in all of baseball together, couldn't hit me as hard as Bo hit me that day. I was 170 pounds on that day. Wasn't good.
Ball tapped to the mound. Bale's going to go to the plate. Dempsey puts the tag on Bo Jackson and hangs on. Third down, 6 yards to go.
So we'll go from the dangers of being a catcher to the hijinks of being an everyday ball player. I can't help but think of you during rain delays running around the tarp-covered base paths and sliding into home plate, pantomiming an inside-the-park home run. When did you start doing that, and what was the inspiration behind it?
Let me see. When did I start doing that? The inspiration actually came from Sparky Lyle. He always wanted to do that. He talked about it when I was a Yankee. We would be in the outfield shagging baseballs during batting practice. He would be throwing them to the part of the grandstands where they would yell the loudest. He got a little kind of a relationship going with the fans. He said one of these days that he wanted to slide around the tarp and throw baseballs in this thing. I don't know. I had an opportunity to do it. When was the first time? In 19... I can't remember exactly. 80 or something like that. I really don't. Might have been even later than that. I'm not sure. But it was this last day of the season against Boston. We were both tied for second place. The Yankees had won the division. It started to rain a little bit during the batting practice on that last day. So I was throwing balls to the people that would scream the loudest at Fenway Park. And I left the field, and then everybody was screaming. There was one ball left on the tarp when they covered it up. It started to rain a little heavier. So I ran out on the tarp. I started sliding around, picked up the ball. Whoever yelled the loudest, I threw the ball to them. When I left the field the first time, the fans started beating on the grandstands. It was so deafening underneath in the locker room. They said, "Dempsey, you better go back out and do something." Well, then I remembered Sparky Lyle saying he would do a pantomime of Babe Ruth calling the home run. So that's what I did. I just, kind of winged it out there. It was nothing that I had really planned. And then all of a sudden it became a rain delay act. So we had fun because, we won a lot of ball games back in those days, and it wasn't anything crazy like eating glass or swallowing goldfish or some shit like that.
As the pre- and post-game analyst for the Orioles on the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, you've had a first-hand look at Buck Showalter and his success in Baltimore with two playoff appearances. This year, of course, hasn't gone according to plan with the team's struggles down the stretch. But comparing what you've seen with Buck and what you know from playing with Earl Weaver, obviously their temperaments are very much different, pretty much on polar opposites, in fact. But aside from that, what similarities do you see in those two in terms of player relations and game management?
Well, the game has changed a lot from the time Earl Weaver was the manager and Buck Showalter. Managers today have to be certainly a lot more diplomatic than Earl was in his day. They have to be more conscious about the guaranteed contracts and the kind of players that come to your team and that sort of thing. The similarities between Buck and Earl Weaver was they are both very prepared to play. They knew the opposition really well. They took advantage of all of the statistics. As a matter of fact, Earl Weaver was the first one to start keeping cards on, what opposing hitters were hitting, the way that their manager liked to manage his ball game. Well, Buck's taking it to another level here. He is probably the most prepared manager I've ever seen and probably the best manager in the game today. Given the kind of talent that he has to work with, I think he would have taken him farther than anybody else in the game. The guy's an incredible manager, and I'm sure someday he's going to be a Hall of Fame guy.
In addition to winning the World Series MVP in 1983, Rick spelled an injured Mike Socha during the Dodgers' final two victories in the 1988 series against Oakland, including Hershiser's complete game clincher in Game 5. A big thank you to Rick Dempsey for joining us. Glad you could tune in to this latest edition of Baseball As It Was.